We know about the problems and inequalities in the education system, and that young people from disadvantaged backgrounds are less likely to enter university than their advantaged counterparts. Deep down, however, I think we still all want to believe that schools give our children and all children a fair start in life. This is why Jesse Abrahams' new book, Schooling Inequality, makes for quite shocking reading. I'm Jess Miles, and in this episode of the Transforming Society podcast, I'm speaking to Jesse, who is lecturer in education and social justice in the School of Education at the University of Bristol. Jesse spent time in three contrasting schools in the south of England. One was a fee-paying school, there was a high-performing state school, and an underperforming state school. She spoke to pupils from different year groups and careers advisors to look at the experiences of young people from different class backgrounds against a backdrop of continuing inequalities in education. For all the political rhetoric around this that we hear, the book exposes that the assumption that raising aspirations is the key to raising attainment and widening access is fundamentally flawed. More damagingly, it results in feelings of inferiority and inability and the calculated perpetuation of social inequality. So how do educational institutions reproduce both disadvantage and privilege? Let's speak to Jesse to find out more. Hi, Jesse.
Hi. Hi, Jess.
Thank you. It's really good to meet you today, and I'm really grateful that you're giving us a bit of time to talk through this very important work.
Thank you.
What I loved about your work and what I found intriguing and maybe quite unusual in the context of academic research is that it's quite emotional, and you give quite a lot of your story, and you're really open about that being a factor in your research and how you feel about it. I wonder if you'd be okay with starting with your story and how you came to write the book.
Okay, thanks, Jess. Yeah, I mean, it's a big question. I think.
Yeah, sorry about that.
No, I welcome the question. I think that it's really important that as researchers, we are open and honest about ourselves and the way that we come to do our research, our interests, and what motivates us and who we are. And I think that being, as you will hear and read if you read the book, I think that being open about our and being vulnerable, I think, is really important to actually supporting learning in lots of ways and helping people to feel comfortable to be vulnerable themselves. So I personally have found that I'm able to kind of be like this partly because some of the professors within my area of research have done that themselves, such as Diane Ray, which is very clear in a lot of her work, that I have had that support. I've seen people be able to be open about themselves, and I can see how powerful it makes their work. So yeah, I hope that I can do that through my research for other people who also feel that. So that's kind of why that's important to me. But to come back to your question of kind of what is the story, so I guess it's difficult to do justice to my story without actually reading the book, but I'm going to try and give a little summary of points that I think are relevant for this podcast especially. I would say that my personal background in terms of my social class, I come from a very working class background. I grew up in quite a deprived area, which was, and I was raised largely by my mother on her own, who has a disability. So because of that, we actually relied on the welfare state for income. But in terms of my education, I would say I actually have experienced some privilege in that I did attend a Steiner school, which is an alternative kind of educational provision. I didn't really have the space to kind of go into the depth of that, but it is, some of it is in the book. Though what I will do is I want to just quote something from the book about the Steiner ethos. So on page 129 of the book, I do write, the Steiner ethos meant that teachers respected pupils and treated them as equal individuals. They rarely raised their voices. There were no strict rules. No one wore uniform, and we addressed the teachers by their first names. In this school, I developed an enormous amount of confidence. I did not feel the weight of authority, nor did I feel restrained or restricted by regulation. So there was quite an empowering experience for me, I think, for the formative years of my life, which was largely a choice that my mother made out of her own poor experiences with comprehensive education. But then, you know, due to the setup of our education system, I ended up attending a local mainstream comprehensive school for the final years of my schooling. And there I was confronted with a very different kind of education, and one which was much more controlled, regulated and restricted, one which was crucially presented very, very specific kinds of limited kinds of careers guidance and options and stud options for studying itself. And as I will emphasize throughout this book, I mean, I personally had a good experience in that school. It was a loving, caring community, which I actually have learned a lot from. But ultimately, they didn't have the resources to actually provide as much options as maybe some other schools.
I think that's something really important to say, isn't it? Is that this, your whole argument is very much about resources that are given to schools rather than what the schools are doing themselves, isn't it? Or individual teachers.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I will say that there are stories that I witnessed through this research that become very clear where there's problematic behavior from teachers, right, from schools, and we shouldn't shy away from saying that, because there is actually a need for some more training, I think, around some of these things that we'll touch on. But I do think the big picture, ultimately, the majority of the issues cannot really be resolved by training and things like this. The majority of the issues, the biggest barriers facing young people, or the biggest inequalities, that is to do with resources and inequalities, yeah, in that. Just to come back to my story, I think there's another moment that's quite important that then leads into how I came to write this book. So fasting forward through my schooling, attended college, and I actually managed to get into an elite university as one of very few working class students at the time. And when I actually graduated, a professor took me under her wing and mentored me. And I started working with her on a research project where we were comparing the experiences of 70 university students from different social class backgrounds. It was called the Paired Peers Project, if anybody's interested. It's still ongoing. And we listened to this, well, as a researcher on that project, I was interviewing young students at the university, and I'd just graduated myself and felt very much like I knew what that felt like. And as I was listening to their stories, when I was hearing the stories of the kind of more privileged students talking about their transitions from school to the university and talking about the kind of careers advice they were faced with and the opportunities, the support and the guidance that they received, I was thrown back to my schooling, and it felt very different. And that was a moment that really sparked a curiosity in me to actually look in depth at three very different schools and actually explore this issue and look at the different provisions and offerings that young people face, as well as, and crucially, their actual experiences on the ground and how that might affect their sense of self and you know, their aspirations, which I'm putting in quotation marks. So I think, yeah, that was really... that moment, added to all these different kind of experiences I've had within education and with different groups of people, has kind of been a big motivation to write a book like this, or do a research project like this, in fact.
Yeah, that really, really comes over in your writing. And I just think it's so amazing that you shared it in that way.
Thank you.
There are actually two stories in the book. There's your two human stories, there's yours. But during the research, you ended up supporting a young person called Jake, and you've brought his story into it as well. And again, you've been so open with this, but it really took an incredible emotional and mental toll on you, I think, from the reading. Could you tell us his story as a way of introducing the issues that we'll go on to talk about here?
I find Jake's story very difficult to speak about. It was really emotional. And actually, it was a really big decision that I faced on whether to even include Jake's story as a chapter of this book. Yeah. So it was almost not a chapter.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't necessary. Yeah, I mean, I'd written this. It was written. I needed to write it partly for myself. And I did kind of think through whether to include it, because it is so personal. Mm-hmm. But as I said to you at the beginning, you know, I do think that there's power in sharing personal stories. And it's also more than a personal story. So I felt that I need to kind of move past my feelings and my connection to this story and actually expose this what I saw happening, which I think is really important that people hear about on a human level, as you say, because sometimes we're a bit more disconnected when we show big pictures in research. So and so I do urge people to read the chapter.
Me too.
And, and I will summarize because Jake's story is really important to the book, and not least because it exemplifies some of the real flaws in our schooling system, and also because I don't actually think Jake's story is unique. Many of us will, when they hear this and read, will recall either being Jake or actually knowing Jake. So I personally could relate to Jake myself, and because of this, the chapter also explores my own personal journey and presents a very reflexive account of my work with Jake and why I felt such an affinity to try and help him. Jake, which is not his real name, was a year 11 pupil in my research who attended Eagles Academy, which is the school in my research, also not his real name, is a school in my research which was located in one of the most socio-economically deprived wards in England, and actually classified what, according to the average benchmarks for results, they were underperforming at the time.
So Jake would have been about 15 when you met
Yes,
him.
that's right. He was 15 when I met him. I think almost 16, perhaps, but yeah, at the beginning of year 11. And Jake was identified as being a bright student, according to many of his teachers, and the bench, the kind of predicted grades or the target grades he'd entered the school in, they perceived he had quite a high level there. But at the same time, he was also labelled as a naughty child, a naughty pupil, a troublesome student who they felt was not reaching his potential because of his poor behaviour. So I would argue, and some of his teachers argued as well and told me this, that they felt he was misunderstood and potentially suffering from learning difficulties which were undiagnosed. Jake had quite a difficult home life, or things were happening in his home life which had impacted on his ability to focus in school. But despite this, Jake was continually being punished for his behavior, and in some instances, there was quite a clear and vocalized disregard for his home circumstances and comments made to me, especially when trying to kind of defend his actions. So I first met Jake through interviewing him for my project. And during that interview, he told me about his aspiration to become an architect, which was a big focus of my project on what were young people's aspirations. But it also became really clear during the interview that despite being a very capable and aspirational student, he was not getting much information or guidance about university at all. And it became even more clear after talking with some teachers, careers advisors about this, that it was because of his behavior, in the sense that they didn't have confidence that he would be able to get to university because of his behavior, in a way. That's to kind of simplify it. But this was the thing that was blocking him from accessing programs to attend and visit universities, information about what kind of subjects you need to study, various work that's done with some pupils in schools to widen participation at university and improve in raise aspirations. So I kind of felt immediately like this is not okay. I felt it was an injustice, and I started bringing some information in myself for Jake around architecture, which is what he wanted to do, and roots into this. And he was very much grateful for that. I also kind of started to work on motivating him to apply himself in certain subjects which he really needed to get into architecture, such as maths. And I tried to do that through a specific kind of pedagogical approach, which kind of really centers around his interests. And I used the architecture itself as a hook to try to get him engaged with maths and understood certain things, like he liked music, and music itself is kind of governed by maths. So I was trying to show him that the things he really is passionate about are part of these subjects that he does need. And I was doing a lot of this work, which ultimately, I will be honest, schools would not have the resource really to just do that, right? Teachers can't work in that close capacity with children, with young people. So I'm not even saying that in itself is something schools can achieve, but it was incredibly valuable, I feel. And I could see that was really helping him. So,
So you could see a change in him. He was responding well to what you were doing and becoming more engaged and
yeah, so this is a real, I guess, potentially a point probably the school might disagree with me on. It's hard to know because I'm not a person that was in his classroom, so I can't claim to know. But what I did see is a change in him as a child, in his work with me, in just in the sense of him opening up more and seeming to, like, when you tell somebody or a young person something or talk to them about something, can they go, "Oh, wow," like they have a light bulb moment. Like, I am a teacher, so I can see, I could could see that there were things that were helping. And not just that, it was more the pastoral work actually that was helping.
Right.
Because as I said, I think that Jake needed some support, but the focus was more on kind of discipline and his behavior. So
yeah.
I think partly because the school didn't have the resources to show that care on a one-to-one basis, when I came in and started doing that and saying, you know what, you are really intelligent. I do actually think you can do this. I'm going to back you and do what I can with my resources to help you. They told me, the young people told me when I would come in every week and work with them, that they really valued that because they had a high staff turnover, I guess. And they said to me that teachers come here and they say to us that they're going to be here for us and they disappear. And it doesn't happen like that. And it's a difficult school. And I do think teachers were leaving, maybe, you know, and they just valued the consistency of my support. So for me, that was something I'd experienced with learning support workers myself in school, actually. And I just wanted to apply that because I felt that that was really useful. Working closely and regularly with Jake, I really witnessed the way in the school that discipline and punishment came a lot of the time before love and care. And this is not one-off, and this isn't new. And Jake's story is an example, really, of the pain that's inflicted on many young people through our education system. The school asked me to leave and they told me to stop working with Jake because... So it comes back to your point on, was it helping him? Now, the school felt that I wasn't helping his behavior and they asked me to stop working with him for that reason. And so I think I found that difficult because my purpose wasn't to, that sounds bad, but I wasn't trying to improve his behavior in a way. Like, I ultimately would have liked to, but I think it was a big challenge. But I was trying to overlook the behavior and help him to move through the system and then get to a point where he could move on to what he wanted to do in his life. So I felt that he was responding in being more engaged with learning on subjects. But perhaps what I wasn't seeing is how he was behaving in the classroom. And I'm not trained to be able to navigate and deal with that. But
so what was it that made the school say, really sorry, we don't think this is working out and it needs to start?
It's a really good question and something that I don't know if I've really ever had answered, because I think that part of the power of education, of the system, of what happened, is the vagueness. There wasn't really something really clear.
In the book, I got a little bit of a sense that this might be really wrong, but his behavior, like you say, you weren't prioritizing fixing the behavior before anything else. You were just kind of acknowledging that and moving on and doing other stuff. But was it a little bit like his behavior wasn't improving, so taking you away was a bit of a punishment?
Yeah, so I realized, I absolutely wrote that, and I absolutely feel that. What became really clear is that the school found it hard to deal with the fact that I, as a person from a university with bringing a lot of resources myself to the school, was standing up there and saying, I want to mentor your naughty kids. They didn't like that because it wasn't just Jake I was working with. And they felt that that wasn't sending the right message to the kids in the school, because it was like, if you're well behaved, we take you to a university in a way. So even though it might not have been a direct punishment towards Jake, it seemed to me symbolic. Like, when kids are talking about it, why is this person coming in and helping Jake, but he's always disrupting my classes? It doesn't feel fair. Like, they saw it as a reward. So,
So it's that conditional kind of, if you behave in this certain way, then we'll open up pathways for you. And if you don't behave in this certain way, we'll close them down.
Yeah.
Your quote in the book, this is a question I was going to ask later, but we're talking about it now. You describe a suspicion of any kind of love, attention, empathy, and support directed at any pupil deemed too naughty.
Yeah.
So it almost becomes mobility, almost becomes a bit of leverage, doesn't it? And something that can be given or taken away as a way of controlling behavior.
Yeah. I was going into that school so regularly to work with them. But if Jake had been in trouble, I was not allowed to work with him.
Yeah.
And I found that, and I do still find that hard to navigate, because even my experience in school, we had learning support workers, Gary and Lloyd, shout out Gary and Lloyd, that's their real names, and they were incredible. And if you were in trouble, they picked you up, and they felt like they cared about us. It felt like they were on our side, and they took us, and we would maybe do our work, but it would help to calm down a situation and de-escalate a situation. And I think that sometimes the system at the moment, or the schools within schools, there are things that they can do, because I think that there are things where schools need to understand how to navigate and handle that when a young person is in that state. And it isn't always about it's I know there's an element where we have to understand that the classroom is full of young people and there's a lot of them to consider. But it doesn't mean that we can just disregard those difficult students.
It's quite, I don't know, it feels as if there's a forgetting somehow about what that particular young person needs. And the end of your story with Jake was really brutal, wasn't it? Because basically you were told to not have any contact with him anymore.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, and that was something that I found that was very difficult. I mean, the school told me that they were going to inform Jake that they've told me I can't work with him anymore. So, but I don't know if that happened. I have not heard from Jake, or there. I don't know what happened to Jake. I know.
Really?
I find it hard to say. I don't want to get emotional in this. I will, because, yeah, I don't know. Jake, who isn't his real name, but if you're listening to this, I hope that you have made it, made yourself happy and you've been able to fulfill the potential that you have. I think as a way of, you asked as a way of introducing the themes in the book, and that what I've said so far, which is really about care and lack of care, I think, and support and love, that's a huge thing that I want to stress, and I think I come back to you later. But there's another element of Jake's story that's really key, that actually touches and speaks to the rest of the other themes in this book as well. His story in terms of his aspirations, and the barriers and the inequalities that he faced in the opportunities to progress towards what he wanted, illustrates a lot of the themes that are in the book, that are based on the research with, much more than just Jake. But it does highlight that, like, just to say, for example, the fact that Jake wanted to be an architect, okay, his school would not have offered him the option to study the correct subjects to package himself in the best way to get into a course to study architecture. So the combination you need to study of subjects was blocked for him. So, yeah.
So let's talk about that aspiration bit, because I mentioned it in the introduction. It is at the heart of the book. So young people are told by politicians quite a lot that being aspirational is really important, da, 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 and then fail to give them what they need to be able to reach those aspirations. You found out something really interesting about young people and aspiration. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I did. I found out quite a few things, so I'm trying to be brief. But I guess, first of all, what I found is the young people I spoke to had high aspirations. High
They all
aspirations.
did, didn't
They,
they?
yeah, well, they had a lot of aspirations. And the majority of them had aspirations. The majority of the people I spoke to, sorry, so not, actually wanted to attend university, had aspirations for particularly kind of middle class careers, if you want to say something like that. And but they were not always aspiring for careers. Aspirations are vast and broad, and it's for not just employment and education. And this is something other people have written about as well. But what I want to focus on is what is meant by then having an aspiration in a very middle class and specific way. Because what was clear is they all have aspirations. But how is that a differentiator? What was actually happening that was causing some of them to actually be able to fulfill their aspirations in a way, or what was the distinction in the aspirations that they presented to me? Because there was some distinction in it. So what I noticed, I think, was really interesting was that there was a difference in terms of social class around their expressions of aspirations as a clear, concrete, this is what I want to do in my future, versus I'm not really sure what I want to do. I want to see how I feel, and I might want to be this or I might want to be that. And it was a bit more vague and a bit more general, broad, keeping options open. And interestingly, I'm not sure if listeners will hear that and be able to assume and work out which way round, because I think that in the past, that's almost the po policy targeted at raising aspirations is potentially assuming that young people don't have a concrete aspiration, so we need to give one. but it was the more working class students or that had a concrete aspiration. So almost you could, it almost felt as if the policy has come through. Now they're just like, this is what I want to be. And they have to have something and they have to say something.
Oh, right. Okay. Because that's what I meant by the interesting thing, because I kind of assume middle class kids would have a clear
plan,
job pathway and plan.
Right.
And it would be the working class kids who are a bit more open and unsure about what they wanted to do, because that's what the policy talk makes you think.
I think that was having a clear plan, one, to prove the aspiration, but also as a strategy to achieve it. Like the school,
right.
I think that they felt that that was what they needed to do in a way, and what they wanted, like, you know, okay. And when I say what they needed to do, I'm talking about already maybe by the time they're getting towards year 11, because it's now when it's like, okay, I need to have a plan. I need to know where I'm going. I have a career because I need to make option choices, you know, and I need to know what options I'm making to get to that future. Okay. And because the stakes are so high within that school and that context, I think it becomes really important, because without that, it's like, if you don't have, like, it is important for them. And I'm not even saying it isn't important, because it is. I think that that's part of helping them, because they do need to have a plan and have those understanding of subjects. But what was, I think it was the strategy almost of advancement of the middle class, I think, that strikes me, because now it's almost like the rules of the game of advantage have changed. Because if we are all now constructing a plan and an aspiration and taking the appropriate steps to get there, how does the middle class and the upper class differentiate themselves in a way? And this is a very kind of academic way of thinking about it, but not necessarily really conscious, but there are conscious stages to it. So I think that it's about, it's a kind of strategy of advancement that centers around keeping options open. So you're not forcing yourself to have to make a decision, because you're growing and you're young and you're going to be able to explore learning and find out your pathway. You know, there's steps and there's a kind of confidence that everything will be okay.
It's privilege, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought about privilege quite a lot when I was reading the book, and just that very idea that you have got choice and you have got different options and you can keep all of those if you want is a privilege that probably the middle classes have and other people don't have so much.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And yeah, it really felt like that. And that, you know, the time to play with ideas, whether you have that privilege and that luxury of time to just, you know, or go and have work experiences and think about what you want to do, as opposed to having to construct a plan to support you and the steps to take that's very clear. I do have something else I really wanted to say about aspirations, because there was kind of two prongs to this. The other thing that struck me that was really interesting about was actually, as I said, the majority had high aspirations. And I don't want to make judgments about what actually classifies as a high or a low aspiration personally. But what I will say is that I made an observation that the year seven aspirations across the schools, in a way, were the most gendered and classed. They were the only real ones that appeared to me as classed and gendered, as I said. And what I mean by that is year seven pupils in my kind of disadvantaged academy school were much like, they expressed aspirations for very working class careers, which you almost wouldn't expect if you're off the back of like raising aspiration policy. So for example, when you see in the book, when the plasticine models made, like,
oh, the plasticine models, what a great way of getting the kids to express themselves.
Thanks. Yeah. And it was so much fun.
Yeah. I've got them.
And so some of them, I'm sorry, I don't have a huge time to go into it, but yeah, I really recommend that. And there's some lovely pictures, you know, of their plasticine models. And so, you know, plasticine models of hairdressing, I want to be a hairdresser, or I want to be a builder, I want to be a mechanic. And these were gendered. The boys were saying those things, the girls be a hairdresser. And it was a beautiful thing. Like, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And they were telling me, you know, my mum is a hairdresser and that's what I want to do. And I still don't think there's any issue with that. But of course, the system applies a framework that says this is not the kind of aspiration you could, you know, especially if you're a student that's getting good grades. Actually, no, why don't you look into something else? So the system is working how politicians would like it to, in that the teachers and the school are trying to boost these kids up and say to them, come on, you can do it. Do you want to be a teacher? And you can get this quality of life or this middle class profession if you want to. Which is another story that then becomes really cruel when they're not actually supported to achieve it. The point I'm making at this point is it's really interesting to observe that this is happening in year seven only, because I would like to suggest and speculate whether this is to do with the aspiration discourse that then is applied through the school. So by year 11, they don't feel able to have an aspiration to be a builder or an electrician or a hairdresser. Perhaps I didn't speak to the ones who still held those aspirations. And again, that might be because they didn't feel that they could present that, because that isn't really a legitimate and accepted aspiration for them at year 11 in terms of what society's telling them. So, and that's
awful.
Quite sad.
So you have to have an aspiration that's good enough and acceptable. And you're kind of pushed towards having that aspiration somewhere between year 7 and year 11.
Yeah.
But then come year 11, like Jake, if there's any kind of other element of your behavior that's unacceptable, then all the resources to help you get towards the aspiration that you may not have even wanted in the first place are taken away.
Yeah.
And it's just such a unfair set. It's such an unfair way of setting people up.
Yeah.
So aspiration is a huge part of the book. And the other huge part of the book is opportunity. And that comes through in Jake's story as well, because of the opportunities that like were presented to him and then taken away, the opportunities that you offered. But I think you talk about opportunity quite a lot in the context of blocking and what options are made available. And as I was reading your book, I've got a 14-year-old who was kind of doing his GCSE options form at the same time as I was reading the book. So it was really resonating. And I was really surprised at the extent to which different GCSE and A-level choices are made available in different schools. So you kind of expect in like the private school, you get your Latin and your Greek and that kind of thing. But even between the two comprehensive schools, there was a big difference, wasn't there? And that obviously block certain choices for certain people. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, thanks. Absolutely. I mean, thanks for saying that. I actually think that's something so key that I wanted to highlight in my work is the real contrast within the state comprehensive sector. Because as you say, when you're going to go and pay for a private education, we almost expect them to have a much vaster range of provisions. And there's, I'm not going to go into whether I agree with that, but that's a fact. So, but actually when you look at the comprehensives and then hold on, this isn't fair. I mean, as I say in the book, I mean, there's a real, a vast difference in the amount of options they're faced with at GCSE and A level and the type of subjects that they're given. But not just the quantity and the quality, like, it is about this blocking. So it's about timetable option blocking systems, right?
Yeah.
And this is something that was so clear to me. In my schooling, I had to do this. I had to pick subject options for my GCSEs based on timetable blocks. So you have to pick one option in block A, one in block B, C, D. And listeners will probably remember doing that in their schooling.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people did. So I was actually shocked when I went into the quite advantaged comprehensive that they didn't operate with a timetable blocking system. So that was the part for me, I would guess, based on my experience, that seemed like, whoa. So these children have like 30 subjects they can choose from. And there are certain restrictions, as you can read in the book, but overall they can create vast combinations of subjects. Whereas in my academy school, their subject combinations that they could make were very limited because they only had a few in each block and that's what they have to choose. So they're
that's basically whether the timetabling's done first or after.
So have the school base their timetabling on student choices, or do they first timetable the classes and then offer it like that? But what I want to say is that might sound like the school's just making a poor decision in how they structure their teaching, but it is not that. It is much more than that, because it's also about the resources that the school has to timetable with the freedom of just timetabling around student choices. That isn't something that was an option, I don't think, in the school that I was working in, because they had very, very limited teaching staff in terms of the subjects that the teachers can even teach, which is partly why they have a limited array of subjects.
Yeah.
And so that they use the same teacher to teach multiple subjects. So obviously, you're going to have slight issues there in terms of what students can and can't study, and the timetabling restrictions. So that's where I think there's a huge implication in resources being directed to enable schools to actually throw out blocking systems, timetable blocking systems, and give more freedom. I'm just a little bit radical, maybe, because I would say if that's not possible, if we're striving for equality, we should impose timetable blocking systems across the board. So all young people
Well, yeah.
have to make choices within that. And then it's something that's just a norm, and we're not seeing one young person as making better choices than another, which is technically false because the options they were presented with were far more restricted. Does that make
Yes, it does make sense. And it's really interesting because when we talk about creating a level playing field, this probably isn't just in education. We kind of go top down, don't we? So go, this is the best possible scenario, and this is what, so all subjects available to everyone, and that should go down throughout the whole system. Oh, but it can't because there's not enough resource. We never go the other way and go, okay, this particular school has to apply timetable blocking. So to create a level playing field, it will go up and all school. We never do it that way around, obviously, because
No, yeah. Well, because ultimately we do care,
you'd be taking away
anybody
something for
imagine.
privilege.
And the people in power are benefiting from that. But not just that, it's hard for us as humans, I think, to say, yeah, let's impose a like when
Restrict,
there's a possibility of not being restricted, why would you say I'm restricting these children? Because we also believe in meritocracy and fairness, and we believe that young people, or even that their parents, have the capacity to send them to a school like this because they worked really hard and they deserve to reap those rewards, and their children deserve to reap those rewards. So it's quite harsh. We do buy into this and we believe in it, and we want this system to exist in a hierarchy. We do. That's
That's the
why we're
whole
still in
thing, isn't
capitalist
it?
system.
Well, and that makes, I was thinking about that as well when I was, there's this really nice table you've got on one of the pages of the book that just lists the GCSE options available in each school and it makes it really clear. And I was looking at that and I was thinking, there is a capitalist thing going on, isn't there? Because some subjects aren't available in the less privileged school than the top school, but then also some subjects are available in the less privileged school that they wouldn't study in the top school. I'm thinking things like health and social care. I don't,
Construction.
I'm construction. I'm making assumptions now based on my stereotypes, but like food and nutrition, that might have been in the top one as well. But there's like a social, there's a capitalist thing going on as well, isn't there, to like feed out certain people into certain roles.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's framed in different ways, and it's framed about being around supporting specific young people's their skills and giving them options that they can do well in. And I do think sometimes schools believe this because they're trying to get grades, they're trying to get outcomes. So they're like,
Which goes back to the
I've
whole,
just said to you, some of the young people in that school wanted to be hairdressers and builders. So why are they? So yeah, okay, we're offering them what we consider to be an option that will help them get to that in some way. So it's like, it's a bit
It's not
complicated
much to
by
do
that.
with skill, though, is it? It's not, there's nothing in class that will make you better at hairdressing or better at, I don't know, health and social care.
No.
It's creating the people to do these jobs, really, isn't
Yeah,
it?
exactly. That is absolutely how we can see that. Like I said, it is difficult though, because I do hear it, because I've been a young person. Like, there is a level where if it's something you feel passionate about and interested and excited in, then you might apply yourself. So I see the strategy of providing
Okay, yeah, that's
those
fair.
options for young people, because it's the kind of works with what I'm saying about focusing on their interests. And like, I do, having read policy, I know that schools, some of this is coming from a good place actually, of trying, but the result of it is that young people are coming out with very different qualifications that are not compared equally, partly because we don't put value in construction and health and social care. See, because like, I would say health and social care could be a fantastic subject. Like,
Oh,
I
yeah.
studied critical thinking and universities, at some point we were like, people were like, that's a silly subject. It was not. It's fantastic. And there's certain things. So I think it's, in the book I write about that, there has been a devaluing of certain kind of subjects like BTECs and things like that. And it's so complicated, because I'm not even arguing that we should bring them back, because there is, it's what happens after and how young people are perceived. So yeah, access to different kinds of knowledge in and of itself can be seen as a welcome policy, But if the knowledge that they're then producing and or the things that they're learning aren't enabling them, that's the issue. And like you say, because even if they get something personally from studying health and social care, is it leading to what they want to do? And sometimes maybe, but often not. So if I actually give an example, then if we think about BTEC science, was something that came out strongly in my research, that young people were being streamed in that academy school into BTEC out of the school's desire to get them some kind of qualification, because the school didn't believe they were capable of doing the GCSE and they had this option. But then later on, when they come to choose what they wanted to do in their career, if they needed some kind of science, they were blocked.
Yeah.
So they're trying to help them with what they consider is more appropriate, but it's actually potentially blocking them later.
Yeah.
Because they've labeled those people as not being capable of a certain level in a way.
Yeah. Thinking about ways of leveling the playing field, in the book you say that during COVID, during the pandemic, we kind of had the chance to do this. Can you tell us a little bit about this bit?
Yeah. So this is a really clear example to me, this moment that I'm going to talk about, of how our system consciously reproduces inequality, I think, for a purpose, as we've mentioned. So, yeah, during COVID, when young people weren't able to sit their exams, many of you will be aware of what happened with an alternative examination system that was constructed, and this algorithm that you may have heard of that was basically applied to all the grades. Teachers were asked to grade pupils just based on basically give predicted grades, and then the algorithm kind of took all the grades that were made and made kind of amendments and used the algorithm was based on past information about the school that the young person with these grades was coming from.
Oh, okay.
So they essentially, what they essentially did, a lot of people don't realize this, is like our system can't support all grades to be really high. This is to do with like a grade inflation and a bell curve and economic things that I personally am not exceptionally expert on. But I will say that what we needed for our system to carry on is for the curve to still work. So they need some grades to be lower and some grades to be higher.
Right.
That's the way I see it. And so what happened is this algorithm is applied to kind of counter what they consider to be teacher bias and try to make the results fit with previous years. So it didn't, it wasn't like really inaccurate. So, and what
so happened- all the teachers predicted grades fed into the system, and then they kind of run the algorithm to give that curve that they would expect.
Yeah. So if you were in a school that was like historically underperforming, let's say, you had more chances of your grades being pulled down, because if the grades from your school looked too high, it didn't seem accurate, right? So there was an intention behind this, just to kind of actually pull it, because it is a hard thing to do. So teachers have, so we're going, okay, those teachers probably boosting them up a bit, let's pull it back down a bit. And there was outrage, there was public outrage, right? This was actually kind of overturned. But what actually happened is they overturned the downgrading of some schools, but they allowed other schools to still be upgraded. So we can't sort the downgrading. And this is, you know, a saying about actually, we can't see how that in itself is problematic, because if we allow some to be upgraded, we're effectively still downgrading people. We're still creating a differentiator, a hierarchy. We're manipulating it, and we're in this situation. They are artificially enhancing it because they needed it to exist. So what I really wanted to mention, if you look in my book as well, there is actually points where the algorithm that was written, there was an acknowledgement by policymakers that the algorithm will reproduce inequality, that in doing this, by the nature of what they're doing, unfortunately, it will reproduce inequality. They've acknowledged it. And then they acknowledge that they explicitly are not going to try to change it.
Because we reproduce inequality all the time. So it has to fit. But then equally, you could have an algorithm that took different kinds of schools into account.
Yes, exactly. And so in the book, I argue how we could have just flipped this. We could have used the algorithm to try to account for inequality and boost up the people who were likely.
You'd have been smoothing that curve though, wouldn't you?
Yes, that's what I mean.
Yeah,
So it couldn't happen, or I don't see how it feasibly would within our economic system that we have. It wouldn't work. But that's an example of how we can actually change something, and how positive it's positive discrimination, but it's not, but it's like recognizing markers of historical disadvantage and historical privilege, and instead flipping them and saying, because you've been historically disadvantaged, let's actually push you up, rather than say, we're going to push you down because you have been historically disadvantaged and you need to stay there. Like, that's quite shocking.
And it's possible, isn't it? It's the kind of the ways of doing these things to make it more fairer there, but they just don't fit the system, do they?
Yeah, they don't. So the will to change it isn't really there, I don't think.
So we kind of need to get towards the end of the episode now. So on the Transforming Society podcast, it's we always try and think about what we can actually do with all this stuff and what we can do with the learning. And everything we've been talking about has been showing that this is just a fundamental structural problem, bigger than individual schools, a capitalist reproduction of the status quo. So it might feel like the system's just too powerful to be changed, but you do identify places where change can be made. To finish off, can you talk us through these? Give us something hopeful to go
Yeah,
with.
absolutely. Yeah, thanks, Jess. I think sociologists tend to be notoriously not great at just providing the solution. So we're saying we hear this is all the problems, but actually, yeah, I would say we need to overthrow capitalism. I do think
All
overall,
right,
back to it.
then.
Bye. No, but yeah, it is bigger than these things. But yeah, like you say, sometimes it feels too powerful that, but there are little places where we can make transformation. So the first thing I would say is we need to, I think we said it, we need to remove blocking systems. I won't stick on that too long because we have said that.
That's to do with like the timetabling and everything like,
Remove timetable blocking systems to, or apply timetabling blocking systems throughout the board. So there's a level playing field and a fairness around choices that young people are given, or options that they're given. And we need to stop trying to focus on raising aspirations and instead focus on opportunities for progressions towards a university or whatever it is that they want to do. And stop raising aspirations is a big one, and it's not a new one. A lot of people have said this and have done research that shows this. So yeah, I do think that's something that needs to change.
I just
Sorry.
had another thought about aspirations that I should have asked you earlier, but by putting it on the aspiration, you're individualizing it, aren't you? So then when the young person doesn't succeed, it's on them because they weren't aspirational enough.
Yeah,
But
absolutely. Absolutely. And that's a big issue, and it's a big part of what's wrong with this discourse, because we're neglecting to recognize the structural inequalities that are lying behind this. And it doesn't take all the agency away from young people in being able to move through, like I've done it, but I really don't want to be seen as a symbol of meritocracy or a symbol of anyone can make it, because there was a lot of reasons why I did, and I don't think it's just as simple as that. So yeah, I mean, but like I say, I don't want anyone to lose hope. I don't think it's impossible for young people to make their way to what they want to do, even faced with really difficult circumstances. And that's what I saw a lot of young people with a strong desire to do that, and we still see that.
So
But
the
yeah.
transformative bit is moving the focus away from that aspiration bit and towards creating the opportunities to do something with them.
Yeah, exactly. And then I guess, kind of connected, I feel that there's a real implication for universities. I think that universities need to understand students' like CVs or the choices that they've made in terms of the subjects and how they've presented themselves when they apply for university. They need to understand the combinations that they may have had restrictions in place before they made their subject choices. We need to see students' subject combinations within context of the opportunities they were presented in the first place. And I think I didn't get to mention earlier, I really want to just mention facilitating subjects being key to that, and that not all young people are taught or have an understanding of what that means. And facilitating subjects are subjects that Russell Group universities advise pupils to take if they don't know what they want to do, if they're unsure. So again, about keeping the options open if you're feeling unsure. So there's a but whether or not young people had the choice of studying all these facilitating subjects is key. So we need to look at their CV and acknowledge the potential barriers.
What kind of subjects are facilitating subjects?
So facilitating subjects, I can find the... so like there's a specific number of them. It's like English, history. I'm trying to, okay. I can get it, it's in the book, but it's like so there's this document called the Informed Choices document that the Russell Group universities produce, which some of my schools were using with pupils, not all of them. And they actually list them and they say these are subjects that are the reason they're called facilitating subjects. They're subjects that are required more often than not in the entry requirements for courses at elite university.
Okay.
So it's literally that direct. So it's like, if you're not sure what you want to study, but you want to go to an elite university, study these subjects because they will mean that there's the most range of degree courses open to you.
Okay.
And they are kind of academic things like English, science, maths. I think it's things like that. Okay. So yeah, if you want to look at it, either Google for, I think it will tell
read
you
the book. Yeah.
It's really interesting actually in terms of whether they were supported to take those or not.
Yes.
And then, okay.
So that's changing the university application process, isn't it? To have something somewhere that indicates on what basis these subjects were chosen. Yeah,
exactly. It could be something quite simple. It really could happen, you know?
Yeah.
As part of our kind of widening participation approach.
Yeah.
We've done things like elite universities have done these contextualized offers where we understand young people's grades as an outcome of an unequal education system where some of them, you know, had a chance to show and demonstrate their potential more than others. So we recognize that and we make specific grade offers that might be reduced to a lower grade entry for students from certain areas and schools because we think that they have high potential. But then why don't we do that with subjects? Why don't we also acknowledge that maybe this student could be capable of doing this degree? So we can give a real example. You want to go into architecture, you don't have every single subject that they desired, and you're now looked at as less desirable than another candidate, but actually maybe you didn't have the choice to
it could be something as simple as like a checkbox on a form that
and then so that's a key one. And my final thing, which should be clear, and the place I really want to end this, is we need to think about a better behavior management system that starts with support. We need more love and care and empathy to be directed to students. And I want to share then this comeback to Jake, just to share with you, for example, a moment, which to me is the kind of things we should be doing with young people who are in these situations. And, you know, Jake, one day, just before I was asked to leave the school, this was when things had really built up. He was really in trouble and he kept being punished and he kept missing his punishments and he was in a cycle. And I came in and he told, and I found out that he'd been in a fight with somebody in school. And he'd told me that what had happened is that his button had fallen off his shirt in the fight, and his shirt had been ripped off and his blazer didn't have a button. So during the fight, he became really exposed and he ran home. And the school would just present this as if he disappeared. They don't know what happened to him. So when I came in and heard this, I was quite shocked. And the next day that I went to see him, I brought a needle and a thread and I sewed a button onto his blazer and he did it up. And like, he was so chuffed. He was like, I don't remember the last time I could actually do this. And it just felt like such an important small moment of care. And that I could see on his face how much that meant to him.
Yeah.
And to see that, to feel that a teacher or someone in that professional context recognizes the importance of that and takes that care, can have such a profound effect on them and on their capacity, their motivation, I think, to learn and to engage.
Yeah.
And then, so bell hooks, I want to end with a quote from bell hooks because I think she's the Bible in some ways around this area. And she says, to teach in a manner that respects and cares for the souls of our students is essential if we are to provide the necessary conditions where learning can most deeply and intimately begin.
Thank you, Jessie.
Do I end it on bell hooks?
I'm very happy to end on bell hooks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Really appreciate that. Thank you for the chat and thank you for writing this book as well. It feels like a really important one. The book's called Schooling Inequality, Aspirations, Opportunities and the Reproduction of Social Class. It's by Jessie Abrahams and it's out now. You can find out more on our website, which is bristoluniversitypress.co.uk. And you can also get 25% off all of our books by signing up to our mailing list when you're on the site. Thank you, Jesse, for a fascinating discussion. Thanks to everyone for listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, please follow us wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you.
Thanks, Jess.